Chapter 8, The Odyssey. The glorious August sun is shining from the east and beginning to reflect brightly against the large white hangar as I pull into dreamland just after dawn. The vibrant blue sky gives way to neon green cornfields, which form a natural enclosure around dreamland. The property's once visible fence line is now concealed by the maturing crop. We've been preparing for this trip for some time, and now the big morning has finally arrived. Rich is busily packing his plane with gear for the trip while the CD player blasts the song Danger Zone. Dan and Jetlag arrive not long after I do. As the resident expert mechanic, Dan does one more quick check of our plane's engines and fuel systems. He makes sure all of the fluids, including fuel, are topped off, hoses look good, and cables are adjusted properly. The planes are serviced and in tip-top shape for the long flight. All systems are go. A lot of time has been invested in locating lightweight camping gear, much of it purchased from a backpacker's outfitting store. Space and weight are both at a premium. The Dacron fabric wings have large zippered openings near each tip where we stuff our bulky sleeping bags and pads. Most of the rest of the equipment is carried in a duffel bag strapped into the right seat. We each have small handheld aircraft radios installed in our planes and simple GPS receivers for navigation. We carefully enter the destination's latitude and longitude and double-check them against one another. The GPS will display distance, direction, ground speed, and wind information. I've spent the last 6 months learning to fly with Dan acting as my mentor. It's been an intense process of studying and practical learning. It's also involved a good number of hours out flying on my own, becoming comfortable with my plane and the changing sky conditions. There were a few times Jennifer and Shannon would fly with me. They really enjoyed float flying. I'd pack a picnic and take Jennifer out to find a secluded little island on the Delta. We'd have a nice lunch and lounge in the sun, then we'd take off and skim along the surface, sightseeing and studying the Delta's wildlife. I delighted in sharing the experience with her, and she liked it when I would perform thrilling swoops and dives. Unlike me, she enjoyed the feeling of being out of control. Jennifer was like a kid on an amusement park ride, and I got a kick out of her uncontrollable screaming and contagious laughter. When Shannon went with me, she was more interested in how to fly the plane. I taught her how each control worked and what the instruments were for. She listened very carefully and caught on quite fast. Once, when we stopped at a marina for fuel, she took the time to answer the attendant's questions with a proud and confident style. Flying really seemed to build her self-esteem. Unfortunately, the girls couldn't accompany me on this trip. I would have loved for them to come along, but there's no room for a passenger with all the gear I have to carry. They did make me promise to tell them all about the trip once I returned. Amelia, with a blissful expression on her face, came out to see us off on our voyage to Lake Monticello. She seems so at ease and content today. Maybe it's the bright morning sun that's making her skin glow, or she's just excited for us. She carefully looks over our planes, inspecting how we have them packed full of gear. She checks that we have everything we need and is impressed with how efficiently we've planned to avoid taking any unnecessarily heavy equipment. It's interesting, though, how she pays particular attention to my GPS. Under her breath, I hear her murmur, "If only I'd had one of these." A wispy puff of air from the west gently bows the top branches of the willow trees. Before we leave, Amelia wraps each of us in a big warm hug, wishes us luck, and bestows a motherly warning. "Make sure to watch those Delta breezes. I'll miss you guys. Have a great adventure and don't get lost out there." In the last few months, I've learned what the Delta breezes are all about. We live near the Carquinez Straits, a gap in the coastal range mountains where the Delta waters empty into the San Francisco Bay. During the hot summer months, the warm Sacramento Valley air will rise and is replaced by a rush of cooler air from the chilly waters of the bay. The wind whips through the straits and has a cooling effect on the entire Delta region. Unfortunately, our lightweight planes are susceptible to strong winds. Flying or taxiing the planes on the ground is more of a challenge when the winds are howling, but so far today the winds are light. I feel a growing sense of camaraderie and excitement to be on our way. With all of the preparation about complete, Rich changes CDs to play one last song, Born to be Wild by Steppenwolf. He turns up the volume and the words echo from the hangar. "Take the world in a love embrace. We were born to be wild. We can climb so high, I never want to die." With the three engines purring to life, we slowly taxi our heavily loaded, fuel-laden planes toward the far end of Dreamland's runway. We anticipate a long roll to gain the necessary speed to lift these hefty birds off the ground. With jet lag at her side, Amelia gives us a pleasant parting smile and crisp, proud salute as we slowly parade by. During the taxi, I check the GPS strapped to my left leg. Before launching, I want to make sure the receiver has initialized and locked on to at least three of the low Earth orbit satellites it uses for positional reference. It's amazing to think that this little black box with four AAA batteries is capable of interfacing with space. Next, I check the volume and squelch on my two-way aircraft radio. About that time, I hear a crackle over my headset and Dan's voice query, "This is Blue Leader. Is anybody on yet?" I look over and see Rich press the transmit button on his control stick. "Roger, Blue Leader. Big Sky is now on the air and reads you loud and clear." Trying my radio, I key in, "Loud and clear here too, guys. Hey, what's my call sign? Can I be Red Leader?" Rich responds, "Negative, Mark. We already have a leader. We can't have two leaders. Why don't you be Tweety Bird?" What does he mean, Tweety Bird? It takes me about 2 seconds to realize that he was referring to my red-colored plane and its big yellow pontoon floats that make it look like the cartoon character of the same name. The other guys had older white floats. The call sign Tweety Bird doesn't sit well, so I ask, "Guys, are you sure Tweety Bird?" As we're about in position for takeoff on the grass strip, Dan replies with a chuckle, "Well, that's a big 10-4 on the tweet handle. Now, are you guys ready yet?" We take off one by one, Dan, Rich, and then me. Right away, I could see how it's going to be on this trip. I'm the new guy, and I guess it's to be expected I'll have to endure the majority of teasing. The takeoff roll is prolonged and the climb out is gradual. It's a good thing we're getting underway early in the day before the hot, thin afternoon air robs our planes of performance. We're each wearing multiple layers of clothing. The morning flight will be chilly, but later in the afternoon, when we arrive at the lake, it should be nice and toasty hot. Climbing and climbing, we slip high over a vast freeway with an enormous traffic backup. Long columns of cars stretching as far as I can see are headed for the urban centers of the Bay Area. I take pity on those poor souls struggling for every inch on their way to a monotonous Monday morning existence. How can they endure such pain day after day? They're far braver than I. Interrupting the constant whir of the engine, my headset crackles. "Okay, let's fly a tight formation and we'll level at 1,000 feet. Big Sky, if you have your camera ready, why don't you take some shots of our planes as we climb with Dreamland framed in the background?" Rich replies, "Roger, Blue Leader. Tweety, how about tucking in under Dan's left wing and I'll get a shot of you guys with the sun on your right?" I reply, "Wilco, Big Sky. Okay, Blue Leader, hold steady and I'll join up on you." With obvious confidence in his plane's stability, Rich releases hold of the control stick and aims his new digital camera as I ease as close as I dare to Dan's plane. As lead plane, Dan just flies and looks straight ahead. As wingman, it's up to me to maneuver over to Dan. In formation flying, only one plane should make adjustments to avoid overreactions. Lake Monticello is almost directly north of Dreamland, but our flight will take us a little east to skirt Travis Air Force Base. Travis, about the halfway point for us, often has large C-5 and C-141 transport planes, as well as KC-10 tankers, which circle to practice takeoffs and landings. As our small squadron proceeds northward, the wind from the west gradually increases and becomes colder. Evidently, the Delta breezes will indeed be a factor for us today. Just as when swimming across a river with a swift current, we find our planes pointing into the left crosswind to keep our ground track straight ahead. And as the crosswind strengthens, our forward ground speed diminishes. It's fortunate we elected to dress warmly this morning. Now with the stronger crosswinds, our range also becomes a concern. We flight planned for an adequate fuel load to get us safely to Lake Monticello, but according to the latest GPS readings, that margin of safety is shrinking rapidly. Our initial plan is to fly at an altitude of 1,000 feet around the Travis airspace, which is well below the 2,500-foot traffic pattern of their large jets. So this morning, looking out ahead, we see no one in the pattern. With the Delta breezes eating into our fuel range, Dan announces over our radios, "Hey guys, I think we better try climbing up higher to see if we can get out of these winds." I keep quiet and let these guys figure out what to do since this is my first trip. Rich replies, "Sounds good, Blue Leader. If we can get up above the inversion layer, the winds should be less, and maybe it'll be warmer, too." Summertime inversion layers are common in the Delta. An inversion layer is an atmospheric phenomenon where cooler air is trapped below warmer air above. Normally, the air temperature cools as altitude increases, but at night, cool ground-hugging breezes can slip into the valley under the warmer air above. One can often see evidence of an inversion layer by observing a narrow brownish band of smog with clean air above. Inversion layers are also responsible for the heavy smog in places like Los Angeles. Dan adds, "Roger, we'll climb up to 2,000 feet and see what it's like. Let's keep a tight formation and our heads on a swivel for any heavy metal." In my mind, I translate what Dan means. He wants us to fly close together so that we'll be more visible to other aircraft. And he also warns us to keep an eye out for any large jet traffic around the airbase. Our conversations have been lighthearted and somewhat silly until now. I can tell by their voice tones that Dan and Rich are now getting down to business. Sure enough, as we climb through 1,600 feet, my little plane buffets from the turbulent eddy in the atmosphere caused by the shifting winds. I can feel the air begin to magically warm, and I smell a pungent chemical odor. Yuck, a concentrated smog layer. But soon, we're above the temperature inversion, and the air improves. Rich says, "Good call, Blue Leader. Much better." At 2,000 feet, I begin to feel tiny sitting out here in the open, with the ground much farther away than I'm used to. But Dan is right. Without the strong crosswind, my GPS shows the ground speed has increased back up to 50 miles per hour. The air has also smoothed out, smells clean again, and is comfortably warmer. What a difference. We cruise along with Rich and me, concentrating mainly on staying tight with Dan, while our leader keeps us on track and maintains a vigilant traffic watch. With this improved fuel economy, making Lake Monticello will be no problem at all. If we did run low on fuel, we'd have to find a quiet road near a gas station to refuel. But with the winds whipping up near the surface, landing would present a challenge. About the time I was being lulled into a relaxed trance from the hum of my two-stroke engine, my headset rouses me. "Heavy metal, 4 o'clock." I look over my right shoulder, and in the distance, just above the horizon, is a gray-colored four-engine cargo jet, which is pointing directly at us. It's a gigantic C-5 Galaxy, one of the largest aircraft in the world. I quickly return my attention to our formation to check that I haven't slipped too close to Dan's left wing. When I look back over my shoulder, in exactly the same spot, the jet, which is trailing a light brown exhaust, has grown significantly in size. Although we're technically clear of the Travis-restricted airspace, these jumbo jets fly a wide pattern, and we're now transgressing it. This is trouble because these big jets can close in fast. If they're in training, their attention may be divided, and they may not be spending a great deal of time on traffic watch looking out the cockpit window. Besides, we're relatively small and have no radar transponders for identification. There's also the tremendous threat of wake turbulence. Wake turbulence is caused by an aircraft's wing slicing through the air. As the wing generates lift, there's a high-pressure area below the wing and a low-pressure area above. At the wingtip, the air below the wing tries to circle up around to fill the low pressure overhead. This creates a horizontally oriented tornado effect. The turbulence usually lasts no more than 3 minutes and gradually sinks below the wake-generating plane's altitude by about 1,000 feet. Previously, I'd experienced wake turbulence firsthand, flying around behind Dan and Rich. Normally, the first indication I'd observe would be the smell of engine exhaust. Then my plane would begin buffeting, normally followed by a roll to the left or right. The roll would typically be fairly gentle and not exceed about 10 degrees. Planes of the same size do not affect each other too badly, but an ultralight up against a huge jumbo jet, and it would be the puree setting on a blender. My mind begins to race as my headset remains quiet. I begin to hear my breathing as I wonder why Dan hasn't said anything. That jet is closing fast. Is this what it's like for a poor little insect before going splat on a windshield? The massive jet is a little above us, so there's no chance to climb now, and we're too slow to try to maneuver out of its way. If it doesn't hit us, we'll surely be shredded in his angry wake. Say something, Dan. Finally, I hear Dan speak in a surprisingly matter-of-fact tone. "Okay, he wins. I guess we're going to have to hit the deck. Let's spiral on down. Blue Leader is breaking formation." To be safe, we have to get well below that jet's wake, so we separate and gently throttle back so as not to shock cool our engines. Each of us enters a descending spiral to lose altitude rapidly. It's a controlled spiral that I've practiced before. We fly tight descending turns, careful not to allow the airspeed or G-forces to get out of hand. We're going down fast, but with the plane's high-lift wings, still not as fast as I'd care to. With each revolution, I see the growing jet bear down on us. The constant turning makes me dizzy, but I focus on my airspeed and altimeter instruments. We follow Dan all the way back down through the inversion layer into the windy, chilly air below. But he doesn't level there. He continues downward. How far is he going to take us? He hasn't lost control or consciousness, has he? Down and down he leads us, my ears popping on the way. Dan levels off just a few feet above the ground. At first, I'm startled when the jet's shadow flashes before us, but relieved to know he's well above. I've tried to be a good wingman and follow along, but I can't help asking, Blue Leader, what's the plan now? Dan replies, How about a low-level terrain-following profile? Looks like we're going to have to resort to Plan B. I saw more than one heavy metal up there, so we'll have to stay down here for a bit. If we hug the surface, we can duck under a good amount of the wind and hopefully save some fuel. I've read about surface friction's effect on the wind. As you get closer to the ground, the wind speed will usually decrease. We knew the wind was bad up at 1,000 feet, so Dan's new plan was to fly just above the ground to lessen the wind's effect. It would be bumpy, but as long as we stayed clear of any large obstacles upwind of us, it shouldn't be too bad. This idea might just get us to Lake Monticello without having to try to find a refueling stop. Besides, it was kind of fun. We no longer fly a tight formation, but a low-level line of follow the leader. Leaving the fields of corn behind, we traverse over marshes and rice fields. Then we skim over rolling golden-colored grassy hills and occasionally pull up to clear barbed wire fences. We stay away from any large buildings or trees that are upwind of us, and we keep a careful eye out for power lines. The trick is to look for the poles that carry the power lines. It might sound dangerous, but at a ground speed of no more than 40 miles per hour, there's plenty of time to see the upcoming dangers, I hope. At one point, we happen to fly over a den of coyotes. One of the coyotes must think we're after him, and he takes off running right out in front of Dan. He runs and runs up one small hillside and down another. With the wind slowing us, it's a fairly even race, but in a short amount of time, that poor coyote gives up and stops in his tracks. He flashes his teeth at us as we buzz just feet overhead, our shadows looming large on the ground. He must think we're the biggest, meanest, noisiest buzzards he's ever seen. Now well north of Travis and the Straits, which once exposed us to the cold and wind, the mountains and the dam that harbor Lake Monticello will soon be upon us. We'll need to climb. We shadow Dan as he slowly advances his throttle to begin the lengthy ascension. The long straws of hay beneath lightly wave, revealing the fact that the delta breezes are much gentler here. The sun is climbing in the sky and heating the earth. Hawks ride the rising thermals of air in search of their rodent prey. As I'd read and experienced months ago, I knew that convective turbulence is the result of hot air currents rising from the sun-soaked ground. We'll now benefit from this rising air like the circling hawk. Updrafts will help lift us back up to a higher altitude. As we approach the mountain pass, I can see we'll need even more altitude for safety's sake. The landscape beneath is no longer the friendly flatlands we'd enjoyed previously. These hills and mountains are covered with rocks and trees. A general rule of thumb in single-engine flying is to never be out of gliding distance from a safe landing spot. This rule is especially applicable to our two-stroke engines. Two-stroke engines are used in sport planes because of their high power-to-weight ratios. But in the past, they earned a reputation for being temperamental. Much has improved with the later engines, but it's still wise to operate them with skepticism. Not only do we take advantage of the rising thermals, but there's also lift to be had from the steep hillsides. Wind hitting the mountains is pushed upwards, and we ride the wave of air for even more altitude. How ironic that now I'm finding turbulence helpful, where before I feared it so. Up and up we go. As we crest the mountain pass, we find ourselves over a large concrete dam. It's been a long morning flight, and the welcome view of the placid blue waters of Lake Monticello thrills us with its breathtaking splendor. Shouts of delight ring out over the radio. Yeehaw! Yippee!